Hello, welcome to another episode of the Podiatry Detectives with myself and my partner in crime, the one and only Mr. Tosif. How are you, sir?
I'm really good. I can't wait for Boris to kind of announce stuff on Sunday and say that things have started to ease down. Tosif, you can go out to the park and play cricket and you can do...
You and me are both going back to work next week, aren't we?
Yes, we are. Yeah, yes, we are. We're going to be open for emergencies, aren't we?
Yes, well, I'm going to be open for emergencies and for anybody that's in pain. So, so it doesn't have to be an emergency where you've got a big infection. But if you're in pain and if you're struggling, then me and Tosif will see you.
If patients would, if that pain leads them to go to the NHS or burden the NHS or the GPs and stuff like that, and it's much better for them to come and see us.
It's interesting because we're both going to be wearing PPE, and we both had a go, didn't we? You can't breathe in it properly. It's especially for people like me and you that mainly see like athletes. Oh, it's not easy. Not easy at all.
I must say, I think I ought to take a picture and put it on Facebook with all the gear that we're going to be having it on now, and we're going to be seeing patients. Yeah.
So what are we talking about today, Mr. Tosif? Because you are leading today.
Right. Yeah, we're going to be talking about posterior tibial tendon dysfunction, and that's what we're going to be focusing on. It is, yes. We refer to that as the PTTD. I've read a few stuff about it. So it's a condition of tibialis posterior, but then the reason I wanted to kind of differentiate between these two is that there are two classes of thoughts that some people say that posterior tibial tendon dysfunction is a different pathology to posterior tibial tendonitis.
I think first we need to explain where the posterior tibial tendon is. Let's first show them a picture, and then we'll talk about the different controversies. Hey, okay.
So let's right. There we go. So, posterior tibial tendon. I don't know whether I can actually hover it on. If there is a way of hovering it onto the annotate mouse. Aha.
Oh. You just want to annotate it. Yeah. Where are you going?
Okay. Thinking that is it possible for me to? But I can't see my mouse.
Okay, what did you want to, or what?
But basically what I wanted to do is I wanted to be able to kind of point on the screen that whether, right, forget about it. I think, let's forget about it.
Yes, we never started it anyway, so. Okay.
Right, so posterior tibial tendon, as you can actually see in the picture, it basically inserts in, it's got like several insertion, which is on the talus, navicular, and it goes underneath cuneiforms as well, and that's where it actually inserts. And what is PTTD? It's defined as loss of normal function due to partial, complete rupture of tibialis posterior tendon, or restrictions of normal gliding motion of the tendon within the retinaculum, which is from medial malleolus. So, right, where is my foot? Right, I'm not very, very well organized today, am I?
I think it's attached to your leg, Tosif. Now move your, okay, there you go.
Right, so here we are. So this is where the retinaculum is. This is where it actually inserts, and then it goes underneath and it inserts right underneath as well.
So before you move on, Just go back a slide. Before you move on, the main insertion is at the midfoot, which is the like navicular, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And then it sort of spreads off. That area where it's running, it will be running just behind your inside of your ankle bone. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yep. But there are other structures there. So we call it Tom, Dick, very nervous Harry, don't we?
Yeah.
So Tom is posterior tibial tendon. So there are other tendon structures, which is why it's very important you don't self-diagnose this yourself, because there are certain tests that we are going to talk about in a minute.
Yeah.
But I thought that would be important to highlight. Okay, do you want to move on?
Great. Excuse me. So one of the main function of the tendon is to basically support the medial longitudinal arch. So without, as you'll see moving forward, that without the insufficiency of the tendon makes the foot basically flattens out completely. It provides stability. And to be honest, posterior tendon and spring ligaments, deltoid ligaments, articulator relationship of the talus and, talar navicular joint helps to maintain the medial longitudinal arch. So the reason I mentioned all the other articulations is because when we get into more latter stages of posterior tibial tendon dysfunction, all of these things get affected as well.
And it helps, it's one of the main plantar flexors, isn't it? So it helps to push the foot in a downward motion. And especially downward and inward motion, that motion. But yeah, that's great. I would agree.
So in terms of diagnosing it, I think you'd probably agree that early stages, a good clinical history, clinical examination of palpation. So you generally be palpating around the tendon area. It's a very hypovascular region, and you can see the pain elicitating from there. More advanced stages, you can start to actually look at other involvement of the joints. So x-rays, ultrasound is really good again in early stages of 1 and 2. MRI is gold standard. So you do, one of the things which I mentioned underneath there is that ultrasound imaging is useful, but it highly depends on the clinician. So
I use ultrasound for this a lot. Well, it helps to confirm my diagnosis. But when you ultrasound the tendon and you follow it down, so I'll follow it from the back of the ankle all the way down to the insertion, you'll find an area where it's thickened. And that will coincide with where you're actually poking with your thumb. So yeah, ultrasound can be highly effective. And just I don't know if you're going to speak about this in a short while, but one of the clinical diagnoses we do is we try and get the patient to like stand on one leg and come up on their tiptoes.
We're going to be doing going through some of these things.
That can be a great diagnosis tool.
Absolutely. So in terms of the causes, there are intrinsic, which are within. Of course, age, sex, previous injury, muscle strength, inflammatory arthritis. So I see, given my role in the NHS with regards to rheumatology specialist, I found that lots of inflammatory arthritis end up causing the latter stages of PTTD. So it's something which gets affected in rheumatoid arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, or psoriasis seronegative arthritis. So it's quite a common sort of site that I've seen in the clinical setting in the NHS. Ligament laxity, how we move, all these things can actually have an impact and can contribute toward the cause. In terms of the extrinsic, it can be environment. So the environment that you're actually working in, running in, doing the exercises in, climate, training errors. So if, for example, especially that's where I want to kind of point out that runners can get tibial tendonitis. And that's where I think the People were kind of differentiating between the deformity or dysfunction to tendinitis. Because it's a progressive condition, some people can get just a tendinitis, and which is not progressive. And that can be due to training errors, traumas. They don't have any predisposing factors which can cause them as a progressive disease, but they can still have tendinitis. But I personally put them into PTTD stage one rather than anything else. So that's how I prefer to do it. Anything you'd like to add on onto that?
I think it's similar with if you talk about plantar fasciitis, such as heel pain. Mm-hmm. And most of these conditions, that initially there'll be some inflammation, but that inflammation soon dies down, and then there are degenerative changes within the structure mm-hmm. of that particular tendon or fascia. Mm-hmm. We can have a long-term impact, which is when it starts going from different stages yep. of it. But yeah, apart from that, yes.
Mm-hmm. So, clinical examination. So a lot of the time when you're seeing patients after the clinical history, that you can find the pain and swelling where the tendon is kind of going underneath. So you can palpate that quite easily. You can see that there is often loss of arch height on standing, tendency to walk on the inner border of the foot, that's more in the lateral stages. Examination in the standing position with both feet compared, so we can actually get them to do heel raises on one, on both feet, and then you can do it on one leg raise. I'll go into that a little bit more detail when I'm talking about the stages of the condition and how and when we do the testing. One of the things which I tend to look out for is too many toe signs. It's something which people can actually do at home as well, so when they're standing. If you're standing from looking at it from behind, if your feet are like that and you can see too many toes, that's three or more toes tend to be one of the clinical signs that I can actually, a clinical test that I do.
Okay.
Anything you'd like to add?
No, not really.
So stages. So stage one, tenosynovitis, as you mentioned, that there is inflammation of the tendon sheath, but you don't see any deformity associated with it. So in terms of the physical examination, they can do single heel raise, but then they can actually have a bit of pain with it. Radiograph is absolutely normal, so you're not going to see any bony changes going on in the foot, because that's in stage one. Anything you'd like to add to stage one?
No, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Stage two, kind of divided into 2A and 2B, you can actually see the tenosynovitis, and along with that you can see a bit of flat foot deformity. But it's a bit more flexible hind foot, so the rear foot is flexible, and the front of the foot is normal function in there. Single raise is negative, or it's actually causing discomfort. You can actually have a bit of mild sinus tarsi pain as well, along with it. In terms of the radiograph, so if you were to actually have a look at the weight-bearing medial side radiograph, you'll see that the arch has actually collapsed in the stage 2B. Flat foot deformity, again, flexible hind foot, but the forefoot abduction, when I talked about too many signs, so the forefoot starts to move outwards. As you talked about the function of the tip post, it is to basically invert and adduct the foot. So it basically moves the foot inwards, and it basically moves the foot in the adducts, meaning moving the foot inwards that way. Yeah?
Yeah.
So you can start to see a bit of that too many signs starting to appear in the lateral stage two. 40% off talonavicular uncoverage, so you start to see a bit of bulging of the talonavicular joints as well. Now, stage three, you can start to see flat foot deformity, which starts to become a bit more rigid. The movement in the joints is reduced. The quality of movement in the joints is reduced as well. They find really difficult to do the single heel raise, or it's really, really painful, or I often find that they just cannot do it. Mm-hmm. There's inability to do the single heel raise. Sinus tarsi pain starts to basically get affected as well. Again, in a radiograph, you would see arch collapse, deformity, and subtalar joint arthritis coming through as well. Stage four is again a rigid forefoot deformity, hind foot valgus. So this foot basically goes into in that position, and it's kind of fixed in there. You start to see all the other structures on the medial aspects, like the likes of deltoids, spring ligaments, the Achilles as well, all these things start to get affected as well. You start to see a fixed sort of articulation of the joints. I've never been able to get somebody to do single heel raise. So it's in stage four. They have severe pain, severe ankle pain, arthritic pain in the ankle as well. So often you find that patient who have got a stage four be there, pretty much there, and their foot is going outwards, and that sort of position that they're in. Anything?
Stage four is really bad. So I tend to see a lot of stage 2B, 3. That's where I normally see them. And it's one of the things, I mean, it's very important to say that I often get them to do single leg heel raises, and I'll count how many they can do on one side and how many they can do on the other side, without them cheating and without them using their hips. And so you have to guide them on it. And yeah, you'll see that sometimes they'll be able to do it, but there'll be less power, and then eventually there'll be pain. Now, in some athletes, it's quite hard to recreate that pain. So you have to do different things to try and recreate.
Absolutely.
Which might include hopping and other things.
Yeah.
Not everybody is going to be, some of them, it may be that they fatigue the tibias, the tib post, at a certain time of their run or their activity, rather than they can't do it at all. So function is really important. What function have they got, and where do they want to get to? Very important. But yeah,
I agree with you. So what I've actually had in clinical sort of presentation is that in my private practice, I've seen several people with stage one and stage two, or early stages of PTTD. However, my 10-year stint in the NHS, I've kind of seen the different stages of this, because being in rheumatology meant that I saw younger patients who have just been diagnosed with the rheumatoid arthritis, started to have foot problems, and they started to basically present that, and it's predominantly the ladies as compared to the men. And it's a scary condition for me. I think if there is a condition in the feet, musculoskeletal condition, which is scary for me, I think PTTD is scary for me, because I've actually seen both ends of the spectrum. I've seen people who have just developed it, and I've seen people getting worse with it. I've seen people who are at the stage four with it, who's gone through extensive sort of surgery to correct that positioning. And it's a gradual progressive condition, and hence why if I see somebody who shows all these signs where I know that it's going to be a progressive thing, I'm very strict, and I'm very, I don't like to scare people, but I'm very realistic, and I tell them that this is where they can actually end up should they not, if they don't follow the plan.
Okay.
So I'll put a quick case study which came across to me in the NHS. So patient, 45-year-old, increased BMI, which is 30, so obese category for her. She was a customer service assistant, being on her feet for a long period of time. Started to develop the pain in the medial arch, navicular region, radiating upwards. So this can kind of give you an idea what sort of stuff that people actually present with. Gradual sort of onset for around 6 weeks. Recently joined the gym to lose weight. Walked 30 minutes every day, gradually worsening, worse with activity, relieved with the rest. So at work, Oxford style smart shoes, and at home, flat slip-ons, court shoes. Again, medical history, so rheumatoid arthritis, diagnosed 5 years ago. Disease activity control is fairly good. Hyperlipidemia, again, medication, we've got the medication there. Methotrexate is for rheumatoid arthritis, folic acid is for rheumatoid arthritis, simvastatin is for high cholesterol. Other activities, walk 30 minutes, visual analog scale is 8 in terms of the pain and foot posture index is +8. Now, in terms of the risk factors and things which we need to kind of look out for is that the classic sort of age between 40 to 60, she's a lady, increased weight, occupation putting a lot more stress on the tip post. Recently, her training error basically comes in because she's recently started the gym and she started doing 30-minute activities. Medical history is rheumatoid arthritis is a big, massive risk factor for her. the word that I mentioned, disease activity control, is good, meaning that if I have a patient who have inflammatory arthritis and they present with these things, so along with me treating the tip post dysfunction, I have to keep an eye on their disease activity control, because inflammatory arthritis affects synovial sheaths and synovial joints and tendon sheaths. So if their arthritis isn't managed very well, then I need to get them get their medication ordered so that their arthritis is managed, and that can help with settling the symptoms of tip post as well. Anything you'd like to add or would like to ask? So for that sort of patient, we did weight-bearing rear foot observation. So you could see like the three lateral toes from behind, muscle strength. So you could see the weakness in the inversion of the foot. So when the foot is moving inwards, that was weaker because that's one of the function of the tip post. Pain against resistance was present. Manual palpation caused the pain in the insertional sort of area of the tip post and along the tendon. Ankle dorsiflexion, so there was a reduced sort of movement upwards, so tight calf muscles is quite often associated with that as well. Supination resistance, so it's a little test which we do with the two fingers on in the medial aspect, and you just lift that, and that can give you an idea how much force is needed to lift the arch up. Navicular drift and drop, able to do double heel raise with no pain and inversion noted, single heel raise elicited pain. I'm not going to go into subtalar axis, and Jack test is, we're not going to go into too much detail about that neither. So that's something which I did in the clinical setting to kind of have a quick look at her. Anything you'd do differently presenting?
No, I would do all of that as well.
Yep. So, so having talked about the case study and the condition and the stages of that, this is where I think I'd like your input in terms of the treatment options. And what do you do? So what do you do looking at that? This is quite a classic sort of thing that we do for any musculoskeletal condition, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't put them into a boot generally. So the first thing I'd be looking at is looking at the kind of footwear they're wearing.
Yeah.
And then it would be orthotics. So orthotics with a gentle arch support. I'm not really trying to change the way they walk. I'm just trying to give them cushioning and support along the tendon.
Mm-hmm.
And then a progressive rehabilitation program. What you said there. So unless they've come to me and if there's a lot of swelling there,
mm-hmm.
so then yeah, peace and love, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories and looking at their current existing drugs. So you might send them off for a blood. And then you're trying to calm shit down. So you're just trying to calm their like symptoms down initially and then try and bring it back up again. Injection therapy is normally after about 2 or 3 months and they're not responding.
Mm-hmm.
I do inject it a lot. In fact, I'm not sure if you've mentioned injection therapy a lot in there, but I've done PRP, pleural therapy, steroid, everything you can imagine. I've taken somebody's blood out and put it back in just to like repair it. Without doing PRP, just their own blood. Mm-hmm. So there are various injection treatment options for it. Shockwave is quite good for it as well, actually.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do? So
in terms of the treatment options for this, yeah, early stages, we do all the things that you actually mentioned. P7 love only if there is inflammation and stuff like that there that we need to do that. I did mention previously, but I often work with the rheumatologist to alter their drugs because I often found that they have associated sort of inflammation because of their arthritis. Modified tendon loading. Now, I have done the offloading of the tendons initially aggressively, and then so that when they're walking around and when they're doing stuff, they are wearing the Acast boot, but I load them while they're doing the exercise. So very modified, very monitored sort of loading in the tendon. And one of the main reasons is that there are two types of patients. If it's a normal athlete presenting with that, no, I'm not going to offload them completely. But the patient suffering with inflammatory arthritis, if they keep on loading that, they will get into that plastic phase of the tendon where coming back to the original state is going to be difficult, as well as they are the kind of patient who are not very compliant with the exercises, or they have like a lot bigger things going on in their body and they can't do the exercises as effectively as well.
This is when your demographic and my demographic would be different, because I don't think I've ever booted anybody for tib post dysfunction or mm-hmm. tendonitis. But I don't see rheumatoid arthritic patients. I never have. So I have no experience. I have to surrender to your experience regarding RA patients.
Like I said, that
I don't know.
So the justification generally I tend to use is that if their inflammation or if their arthritis or disease control is not very good, then them basically further loading that tendon is going to be a problem.
Okay.
While we're basically getting that into a control, which can take a few weeks, and some cases a couple of months as well, at that time, I want to protect that tendon as much as possible so that we're not causing the long-term sort of effect damage. And like I said, it's a scary condition, which is a progressive condition, and I don't want people to be getting to stage 3 and stage 4 if we can help it.
Okay.
So that's so I've done that. In terms of orthotics, my justification for the orthotics tend to go by like two ways. That if the patient is young and it's early stages of their condition, then I'm going functional. I'm controlling the function along with the footwear, and I'm doing all that. I read somewhere Craig Payne, one of the gurus in biomechanics, he said that if I could actually put a steel insole into these people's shoes, he said that he would. That's one of his saying. So I use that, but if they are in the latter stages or if they cannot accommodate the functional orthotic, then I would use accommodative.
I tend to disagree with you and Craig Payne. I don't like giving functional for tip post dysfunction. On very few occasions I will give them. When we talk about functional, we're talking about giving wedging, in this case, on the inside of the orthotic.
Yeah. Or supporting
external or internal. Yeah. And that would be changing the way you walk.
Mm-hmm.
I generally like to strengthen them. I just like them taking.
Well, that goes without saying. So they have to be strengthening. They have to be doing their rehab. For me, both things go together.
This is just a different school of thought. I think if you're giving them a functional orthotic, I don't think they are working the tendon when they're walking and running. As they should, so that affects the kind of rehab they do. But let's like agree to disagree there. But yeah, everything else I agree with.
Mm-hmm. Orthopedic footwear is something which I used a lot with my demographic of the patients because of if they have other deformities and I need to give a good, thick, functional orthotic and they can't fit it into their normal shoes. So along with that, I find that a good orthotic, especially a good functional orthotic, is only as good as the footwear it's actually fitted in. If the footwear is crap, then I find that they're not going to get the benefits that we're trying to actually achieve. As well as if I find that there is a medial deviation of the foot, in the midfoot region, you can't just basically control it from the bottom. You need to control it from the medial aspect, and that's where the shoe comes in for me.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned about the injection therapy. To add to that, I don't think I would recommend anybody doing a blind one. It would always be a guided injection for me.
See, this also depends on where the tibialis posterior is most
tender,
dysfunctional or tender or hypoechoic, which meaning is darker or more thickened. So if it's at the insertion, at the navicular, there's different kinds of injections you would do for that. And I generally, I think, so if you're giving a steroid injection, you're looking at just calming symptoms down so they can do rehab. Mm-hmm. But sometimes regenerative treatments like pleurotherapy, which is a mixture of glucose and local anesthetic, or PRP, which is platelet-rich plasma, can repair a damaged structure.
Mm-hmm.
Which can be an option. And as I said, autologous blood injections, which is when I just take the blood from, when I've just taken the blood from the arm and I've just re-injected it straight back in, especially if it's at the insertion point at the navicular, mm-hmm. works really well. I've done TruMeal for this as well, which is a herbal injection, and it's worked really well. Just as a side thought, I've just remembered one of my patients who had been around the block for this and been to many podiatrists, had came in with, you know, when they come in, when they've got a whole bag full of orthotics, you think, oh no. And you know, like, and they start talking about, I've been here, I've been there. And you're thinking, oh great. And the guy did all the rehab. To be fair, he was a footballer. So he's not as though he didn't do the rehab. With him, he had tip post dysfunction, but he also had an osteochondral lesion in his talus, which is basically a bit of the bone at the top of the ankle, came a bit loose as well. Sometimes this posterior tibial dysfunction can hide a whole myriad of other conditions within it. So sometimes, as me and you have always said, that curve that you think that it's going to go really well, and then it goes downhill. Sometimes if it's not getting better, as you would agree, if it's not getting better and you've done your eccentric loading and you've done all of this, if it's not getting better, it's always best to just go back to square one and think, okay, let's go back over the diagnosis. Let's be sure that there isn't something else going on here, which I think is important to consider. So yeah,
I think for me personally, as soon as they get into like stages 3 and stage 4, it's far more complex than just about orthotics, rehab and stuff like that. Times have actually passed for all these things.
Then you're looking at that stage, you're looking at either surgery, yeah, or you're looking at proper orthopedic footwear, or if it's a young active person, then you're looking at quite a rigid carbon fiber orthotic. Yeah, they can tolerate it.
Yeah, in terms of imaging and my diagnosis, I definitely, at that stage, I definitely would consider getting an MRI and have a look at the whole structure of the things rather than just worrying about the tip post. And as I mentioned in the initial anatomy sort of slide, that there are lots of different structures which are supporting the midfoot and the inner side of the foot, and they get affected in third and fourth stages, and you need to kind of look at the extent of that and perhaps manage it as a holistically rather than just thinking about tip post.
I agree.
Anything more to add
on the treatment? No. Have you got anything else?
So in terms of rehab, so there is a paper done by Cooley et al. 2009. These are the basic sort of exercises that I've actually added in there. And of course, there are, you can go simpler than these, and then you can go more advanced than these. We talked about these in several of our talks previously, that how we would progress, how we would regress, and the plyometrics, and how you'd basically be focusing on the sport specific sort of exercises, but these are the basic exercises one needs to do to be able to. And if somebody is wanting to do these things at home, this is something that they can actually start off from. Plain and simple, Kulig did a study which said that if you've done resisted inversion, resisted eversion, plantar flexion and dorsiflexion when you are standing.
Steve, you're going to have to explain to people what inversion and eversion is.
So
you can't use those terms.
So the reason I'm using the terms is that the explanation in there with regards to the exercises there, I don't know whether you can read it or not.
No, but people won't understand it. So what is inversion?
So inversion is moving inward. So the foot is moving inward, and the eversion is foot is moving outward. So when you have a TheraBand, which basically holds and pulls it from this side, so you're doing it against resistance. So make sure that you're not using the whole leg to move it inwards like that. So it's the foot that you're focusing on moving inwards. And then eversion, you do the same thing and put the TheraBand or the band exercise band there, hold it here, and then move the foot outwards like that. Excuse me, my throat is dry and we can't even drink, can we?
It's not easy to do like when you're fasting, is it?
It's not. Yeah, I must say that last was the first. No, we did one before actually. Yes, the last one you talked about it pretty much most of the presentation, didn't you? And I feel sorry for you.
Okay, so I'm gonna give you a voice. I'm gonna give you a voice a little rest here. I often move from this to the next. This is I would put into like a neuromuscular phase of training. I would move this quickly, if I can, with my athletes and my patients, and to strengthen endurance. So regarding the single leg calf raise, when you're standing on one leg and you're coming up, I would get them to hold some dumbbells or get a get a backpack with some bottles of Coke and start adding stuff on there. I would also get them to sit down and do work on their calf muscle. So you're seated and you're doing a calf raise. So that's working a different muscle. And then I'm moving on to a lot more. I'm doing a single leg Romanian deadlift, which is very, very good, because I'm going to get them to stand on one leg, hold a kettlebell or a dumbbell and gently lower it, come back up again. That's really working their tib post and their ankle complex. And if I'm working on different kinds of plyometrics like box jumps and hopping and hopping in different directions, maybe we're working on proprioception. So we're getting them to stand on some sand or uneven surface and then trying to like throw them a ball to catch. So we'd be progressing them on. But what you've given there, those first four exercises, are brilliant for the initial stages of tibialis posterior tendinopathy. If anybody's watching this or listening to this that wants these exercises, please contact myself or Tosif. Both of us can give you a sheet with these exercises, and that will start you off on your road to recovery. Is anything I said out of place or
no? Absolutely perfect. Surgery. Now, it's something which I've seen quite often. I've sent my patients to have the surgery. I've seen them afterwards. I've seen the successes. I've seen the failures. And it's very much dependent on who's doing the surgery. I find some orthopedic consultants are really, really good at doing midfoot to surgery. The gentleman who we had in Buckinghamshire was absolutely amazing. So he did several surgeries for my patients. FDL and FAHL tendon transfers are more like in 3 and 4, generally tend to do they take another tendon and replace the affected tendon with it.
What is FDL? What is FHL?
It's a tendon off another muscle, to keep it simple. And they basically replace the tendon off tib post with it. So flexor digitorum longus and flexor hallucis longus. So it's tendon off another muscle, like I said, is basically replaced. And that's not too bad. I actually had fairly good results. Patients have been like really happy with it. Did they get like proper function back? Not really. But do they get pain-free, relatively pain-free? Yes. With an improved function? Yes. Calc osteotomy, which is calcaneus, is the calc bone, which is here. So a lot of the time in the advanced stages, you see the foot basically goes into this sort of position. I don't know whether that's very good on the image or not of it.
Yeah, I can see it.
So calc osteotomies generally tend to be where they do a little cutout in the calcaneus bone and just shift it on the inward and straighten the foot out a little bit. Haven't seen much of these or experienced much of these myself, but it is something which surgeons tend to do that. Achilles lengthening, that can work quite nicely as well to basically give them a little bit more ankle dorsiflexion movement and helps with the movement because if the foot collapses too much, the foot can't propulse forward if there isn't a lot of movement in the ankle joint. So by doing that, that helps with the function as well. Fusions, I've seen a lot of fusions. Have you?
No.
So fusions is generally where they look at the joints and which joints are basically affected or stuff, and all they do is they basically screw them, fuse them together so that there is no movement in the ankle sort of the complex. If there is no movement, the pain tend to disappear, but the foot can kind of tend to basically get into a fixed sort of position. Severely affects their gait, but a lot of the patients who have stage four have all a lot of other sort of problems as well along with it. So it's their gait is affected. If, for example, they've got rheumatoid arthritis and stuff, their gait is affected anyway. Anything you'd like to add?
No, I've never sent a patient for surgery for this, so I can't really add anything to it.
Okay. I know
of FHL and FDL transfers, mm-hmm. just from reading about them, but I generally don't have that demographic where I need to send them for surgery.
Mm-hmm. Any other treatment options? This is our last slide. So is there anything else that you would like to add to?
For tibial, I mean, there are some people that are doing shockwave mm-hmm. to tibialis posterior tendon, which can help. As always, we need to take a global view on them. So we need to start looking at, especially for the more athletic population, we're looking at further up in the kinetic chain, seeing is there a reason why they're loading up the inside of their leg too much. We might be looking at the way they run, so we might look at gait retraining if they're a runner. And generally speaking, I think you covered everything. The more invasive treatment options are injection therapies, but generally speaking, I said generally twice then, treating it with rehabilitation exercises and orthotics is a really good choice.
Yeah, in my private setting, a lot of the patients presenting with the early stages generally tend to get better with the rehab and the orthotic footwear, better footwear and stuff like that. And I do tend to stress on, because it's a progressive condition, it's not like a condition like Achilles tendinopathy. You develop it, you heal that, and then you're ready to rock and roll. This can be a progressive condition, so they need to ensure that the strength is always there for the activity that they want to do. So they can't just suddenly get up and say, right, today I'm going to go, I haven't run for like 6 weeks, and today I'm going to go and run 20k. They just cannot do things like this.
I've had quite a few female runners with this. Very, very difficult. Very difficult. But there you go. Is there anything else that you want to add?
No, that's. I think that concludes our the podiatry detectives series for now, doesn't it?
Yeah, we're taking a couple of weeks break.
Should we?
Do you want to end the screen share for a second? And get to see your. Get to see your face in full glory. So we're taking a couple of weeks off, aren't we?
So is it fair to say that season one for the podiatry detectives ends today?
Maybe, but we really wanted to make we've got a lot more to cover. So we were going to cover Achilles tendonitis, tendinopathy, calf strains, different kinds of calf strains, and then we were going to go into the principles of strength and conditioning, maybe gait retraining. There's a lot more we need to cover. There was quite a few different things that we wanted to cover.
Yeah.
We haven't even covered all the conditions from the foot and the ankle yet. But we have done in the last seven videos. It's been six or seven.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Six.
How many?
Six, I think.
Six, yeah. And now you're a natural, Tosif. Absolute natural. Look at you. Check you
all
out.
Thanks to you. I mean, all thanks to you.
Check you out. All right. We have covered a lot in the last 6-7 weeks, and then the next 6 or 7 will be after a little while because we've got a lot on at the moment. But hope anybody that was listening or watching this has found them useful. If you have any questions, drop Tosif an email or myself an email. Both of us will gladly give you any advice about your foot, ankle, or leg condition.
Yeah, once again, thank you everybody for listening. We'll be back, Sherlock.
Yes, we will, Colombo. Yes, we will. Take care.